When we're thinking about, I know you said that your expertise is particularly more the more modern period, so I now want to take us to this last 200 years. What are the big stories that we must know in relation to Gypsy Traveller history?
In the UK itself, I mean, I think the thing... So one of the things that I always bang my drum about is that we can't see Gypsies and Travellers being separate from what's happening to everybody else. You know, we live on a small island or collection of islands. It's inconceivable that they've not been affected by the same things that have hit the rest of the population. So urbanisation, you know, industrialisation, the rise of the welfare state, the rise of education, all of these things have, you know, affected Gypsies and Travellers just as much as they have the wider population, but in very different kinds of ways because of their particular place in the economy, but also how they locate themselves culturally and how they are positioned in prejudicial ways by the state and wider population. So if we take something like urbanisation, we've got what we see obviously across, you know, anyone who's familiar with the story of 19th century British Industrial Revolution knows how very quickly Britain urbanised across the 19th century. And that meant the massive expansion. It didn't just mean people moving from the rural areas to the cities. It also means that, you know, the populations are increasing through natural expansion and the towns physically themselves are also getting much bigger. And if we think, so what might that mean for Gypsies and Travellers who traditionally have been moving around, engaged in both seasonal agricultural work and other work like, you know, mending pots and pans, tinkering, selling small items and things as they're going around. So the first thing that we see is that lots of them are also turning up in towns and cities. And so there's a wonderful account, for example, by Arthur Harding, who was a low-level East End crook. So Raphael Samuel, who was one of the pioneering oral historians in the 60s and 70s, did a recording with Arthur Harding, who'd been brought up in the East End in the 1890s onwards. He went on to sort of have associations with the Cray brothers and, you know, he's that kind of guy. And it's what's really interesting is that when we look at his accounts of East End life at that turn of the 20th century, how embedded gypsies were. And they were local, you know, they were local. They weren't like just rocking up in their bow-top caravans for a bit and then disappearing. They were living alongside people, particularly over the winter, and doing things like collect. So they would be involved in what we think of now as the secondhand clothes trade. So they would go around and beg and get, you know, for very small amounts of money, clothes. They would... and then resell them in other areas, or they would sell them on as rags. So they would do similar things with furniture. When it came to, if we think of, you know, the East End, we'd think of, you know, how the big hop picking exodus that used to happen every year, where people from the East End would go out to the hop fields of Kent in particular, but also Hampshire, and engage in that seasonal work. And it was kind of a holiday, and it was also a way of earning some extra money. And so we see the gypsies of the East End doing that alongside the rest of the East End population, and also then travelling round the fairs as well. So fairs in the 19th century became a really big thing. You've got these, the fairs are a hangover from the medieval period. They're a set period times of the year. They're often held in, you know, public land, which remains sort of public land because it's often on commons and areas which are seen as being in some way common property, so that even though when you have the mass expansion of the towns, you still have these spaces that are a bit, you know, they're still a bit not quite free, but, you know, they're there for particular things. And so the fairs carry on, and they're increasingly what used to be at the edges of towns and cities, sometimes now like right in the centre. And these fairs, you know, happen in around over the course of the year. And so you have some gypsies and travellers starting to specialise in moving between the fairgrounds, taking advantage of those, you know, wonderful improvements in technology and engineering in the 19th century, which meant, you know, not just steam engines and trains, but also meant steam fairs. It meant swing boats, it meant helter-skelters, it meant, you know, the rise of what we now think of as being, you know, chair-a-planes, dodgems, all of those things. We start seeing the high point of fairs being in the late 19th and the early 20th century, where you've got, you know, large crowds of people who've got some time off and they've got a bit of money in their pocket, and the fairs become a really big thing. Similarly with the races. you know, Epsom, the Derby, you know, the Derby, those kind of things, they become much, much bigger as they we see, you know, along with the rise of industrialisation and urbanisation, the rise of leisure and leisure cultures, and gypsies and travellers are profoundly tied up with that. Not just in, you know, London in the big cities, but Blackpool, the South Shore at Blackpool, for a lot of the late 19th and the first years of the 20th century, there was a big permanent gypsy camp there, and they were living between, they were living sort of in a sort of a liminal space at the top of the beach, which wasn't I think it was Crown property. There's this sort of weird bit of the strip of land, isn't there, which isn't really anybody's, and they'd parked themselves there, and they, you know, took advantage of the mass rise in leisure that happened. You know, so all the, you know, people from the mill towns were coming out for their Saturdays and their half holiday days, and it started off as being palmistry and, you know, fortune telling and those kind of things, but people got into again to some of the seaside and the fairground rides. And so a bit, you know, Butlins, Billy Butlin, he came from a gypsy family who, I mean, I could talk about the rise of the Showman's Guild, but that's a whole separate thing. But anyway, he was blacklisted from the Showman's Guild, so he couldn't run his rides on fairs, but the Showman's Guild didn't cover the seaside resorts. And so you see by the, you know, the first decades of the 20th century, some gypsies moving into the seaside amusement arcades, those kind of things. And in the Butlins case, obviously the, you know, the big holiday camps too. So you've got these, you know, in some ways you see gypsies and travellers being, you know, thoroughly embedded into these emerging urban economies, that where mobility is a normal part of everyday life. If you think of the number of people who move from the countryside to the cities in this period, then the mobility of gypsies and then people, you know, poor people often moved a lot within localities because, you know, they were looking for work, or, you know, they had to do a midnight flit because they couldn't pay their rent. And although, you know, there's often this narrative of, quotes, the traditional working class urban community, that's very much a product of the post, you know, certainly the, you know, post 1918, and, you know, it's the mid 20th century. Whereas in the late 19th century, what we have is much more sort of churning of the population, and gypsies and travellers are part of this churning population. And the other thing that I think is useful for us to think about in this time is that the way that they were living when they were outdoor, you know, if they were, when they were mobile, rather than if they were living in cities, or what was very common is that people would go, they'd try and find somewhere stable for the winter and then travel during the summer, because it's grim being out on the road in all the mud and the cold and the dark. And if you can find somewhere that's static, either it's, you know, cheap rent in town with a yard out the back where you can put your horse, or it's a common on the outskirts of a town where you know that you'll be able to do lots of hawking and lots of business within a very close area, then it makes sense for you to stay put. But essentially, you know, this is the time when, you know, working class people are, you know, 12 people in a room and they're all sharing one privy, and, you know, there are low levels of literacy. And so when you think it in a sort of a physical way, there was a lot of overlap between the kinds of lives that the general working class poor were living and how gypsies and travellers might be living. And so one of the, if we sort of move through now into the 20th century, I think one of the things that's interesting is how we see an increasing divergence between those two positions, and that, you know, education become and literacy becomes normal for the mass of the population. Having indoor plumbing becomes normal. Having central heating becomes normal. All of these, you know, all of these things that, if we're sort of thinking, you know, the rise of consumer culture, the rise of plastics, the rise of, you know, piped gas, all of these technological innovations that have made profound differences for the settled population, we can see they're one of the ways in which it started to create a bigger gap between, you know, normal working class lives and gypsy traveller lives. And then I think it's useful for us to think about how that interplays with two other things, which is sort of, you know, the rise of the sort of the state and the control of space, and also the kinds of stereotypes that swirl around gypsies and travellers. I mean,